Hello and salam alaikum. I'm Shalina Jan Mohammed, and this is the second episode in the new series of Muslim Women Talk Ramadan, the podcast that's by Muslim women for Muslim women. Consider us your weekly pep talk Ramadan BFF, all wrapped up in your warm hug that you need during this blessed month. Yes, it's week two. I have had my first pre-iftar headache. I've had my first post-iftar headache. I've had my first iftar. I've eaten all those samosas that you know that I love. And I've been sitting down every day with the kids to talk them through iftar and enjoy Ramadan with them. Now, this series, as you know, we're focusing on power, specifically women and girls' power, and what that means to all of us. And I'll be talking to our leadership coach and Ramadan BFF, Henriette Sovati, to guide us through what we can do to take that power, how we take the yes-no, and what's holding us back. Plus, I've got special guests for you every week. Last episode, we had the fashion model Maria Idrisi, and this week, I could not be more excited to have former Foreign Minister Dunya Mahmoud talking to us about her Ramadan and what power means to her. But first, I'm going to chat to my lovely daughters, Hannah and Iman. And yes, I know they keep stealing the show and I keep bringing them back, but they have so much wisdom and I love hearing their perspectives about what it's like to be a girl today, thinking about Ramadan and power. So let's see what they've got to say this week as we kick off with a game of Would You Rather, Ramadan edition. How are you, Hannah? How are you, Iman? Salaamu Alaikum.
Salaamu Alaikum. I'm amazing. How are you, Hannah?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. We're going to start this particular conversation about power with a round of a game called Would You Rather. Ooh. So I'm going to give you...
Ooh. My favourite.
So, would you rather have the power to make people listen to you or the power to turn invisible?
Make people listen to me because... Oh, wait, Hannah, go.
I would get people to listen to me because there's a lot you could do if everyone would just listen, to be honest. Like, you could use the power for good. I mean, you could use it for bad, but if you could get everyone to listen, then you could get so much done so much quicker.
Iman, would you get people to listen to you or turn invisible?
I want to make people listen to me for two reasons. First reason, people barely ever listen to you, and sometimes they don't even give you a chance to... answer because they think their idea is so good. So if you can get everybody in the whole wide world to listen to you, you could even get people to listen to you and give their invisibility scientific stuff to you. And it's probably not true, but if they manage to create something that can make you invisible, then you could like take it because they'd listen to you.
Would you rather always have the last word or the best snacks?
The best snacks, because it doesn't really matter to me that much about having the last word, but imagine having the best snacks just
hand. What would the best snacks be?
But it doesn't matter. You wouldn't need to know because they'd just be there. So, you know.
Iman, best snacks or last word?
Last word, because if you had the last word, you'd win the argument and then you can get the best sweet.
Would you rather be Prime Minister or the most popular kid at school?
Prime Minister, because then you can make yourself the most popular kid at school.
I mean, to be fair, if you were a child and the Prime Minister, you'd probably...
I mean, you could be a child, but there were children who ruled Alexander the Great, as you guys like to remind me. So... we're talking about what makes it difficult to have power, especially for girls and women. And it's really fascinating for me to hear what you think, because you're growing up in quite a different place and time to what I did. Do you think that sometimes people expect girls to be nicer or softer? Have you felt like that?
Yeah,
definitely, I think.
In what way do you think people want girls to be nicer or girls have to behave like that?
Just in general, like if someone's more passionate about something but they're a girl, then they need to like calm down more.
People usually think like female people are much softer and sometimes they're not, and sometimes it's unfair, but sometimes it's kind of good because it can make women better, but also it's bad as well because they're not treated the same. But sometimes it's okay because there's nothing that's happened. Everybody's treated the same. Lots of the time, everybody's treated the same, I think.
Have you ever felt like you've just had to be soft or nice just to keep the peace, even if you didn't want to?
I think in a sense, yeah, because sometimes it's just better to, like, let the other person think that they've like kind of won the argument in a sense, so that they just don't escalate it to an amount, because it could just be a really small argument and something that you don't want to spend that much time on.
Have you ever said yes to something and then regretted and wish you had said no instead?
I think yes, but most of the time it's just like things like extra homework and like just extra work from teachers and things that like seem like a good idea, but then just end up being a lot more stressful and things.
Just thinking about that question the other way though, when you feel like somebody really listens to you or respects your opinion, how does that feel?
It feels good, because like especially if you've spent a lot of time thinking about like a certain point, then when you explain it and if someone like genuinely understands your point of view, then it feels good to kind of feel acknowledged.
So if I wanted to do more of that, what would you like me to say?
I don't know.
Well done, Hannah. Well done, Iman.
Yeah.
Iman, are there any particular positive affirmations you like that help you feel stronger and more powerful?
No.
That makes it sound like I don't say anything nice to you at home. Do you ever feel guilty for saying no?
I suppose everyone does, to be honest. Because, you know, like, unless, like, you really don't want to do something, there's always, like, some part of you that's like, oh, maybe I should do it, you know? Like, it wouldn't take that much effort. It's just a small thing.
One of the challenges that a lot of women talk about, and it'd be interesting to hear what you think girls feel about, is lacking in confidence. So that even when somebody gives you an opportunity, you don't feel you should do it. Is confidence something you and your friends talk about?
Not really, but I think it is something important because, as you said, if someone like offers you something really that could like really change your life or something, but you don't want to take it because you lack in confidence, or even something small like a class project, you could like miss out on so many opportunities just by feeling a lack of confidence.
So Iman, I am going to gift you for Eid a confidence button, which means that whenever you feel like you need more confidence, you can press the button. Hannah, I'm looking at your face. You look like you also want a confidence, but I'll give you one too. So, Iman, if you have your confidence button that you feel powerful when you press it, when are you going to use it?
I'm not going to use it.
What?
And I'm not going to use it because if you need a confidence button, what's the point in having it? Because obviously you're meant to not have the confidence. Because sometimes you don't need confidence. Sometimes you need fear. For example, if you're doing an exam, a really, really hard one, you want to have some fear so that you can get a bit stressed out, so that you can be scared enough to work really hard on it. If you're completely confident, you can just rush through the whole exam and get 0 marks. You still have to be a bit scared.
So you're saying that you need a balance between being confident but also that you're not quite overly prepared for it. You do need to have some nerves about it. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
I think it's just, if you have a confidence button, it's more like when you feel like you should use it, because I think if everyone had one, they'd use it all the time for everything. And if you need it to like use it to like go to the shops or something, then your kind of personality is going to be the exact same when you're just like living your daily life, and also when you're presenting and you're going in front of people. And if it's not who you already are, then using like confidence all the time that you don't have is not going to be great in a sense.
So what you're both saying, just as a final thought, is that the process of going through the fear is to develop your own confidence and to grow who you are as a person.
If you have like automatic confidence, you don't really go through the process of trying to build up your confidence.
And also, you're never going to grow as a person. You're just going to be a lazy old person who never tries anything, because you can just press your confidence button all the time. And then when your confidence button finally runs out of battery and you can't get new batteries because it's a special charger thing, when it finally runs out, you're never going to be confident again.
So what I'm taking away from this conversation is that I'm not giving you guys confidence buttons for Eid. I have to go back to the drawing board for your Eid presents.
Yes.
We're fine with just Eid, don't worry.
See you at Eid then. Thank you. It's always so nice to chat to my girls on this podcast. The wisdom that they share when suddenly there's a microphone on them is completely different to anything else. Although those little coughs and sneezes, sorry about that. But I guess the kids are always going through that. And they have such fresh perspectives to share about what it means to be a girl today. And hopefully those intergenerational conversations give us some prompts about the things that we can do to support them as they go forward too. And what I'm going to have to now think about, given that they don't want a confidence button for Eid, is a new Eid present. If you have any suggestions, send them through to me. You'll find me on all the socials. Now, it's time to welcome back to the podcast one of my favourite people, our very own Ramadan BFF and life coach, here to give us a pep talk and set us up on the right path, Henrietta Sovati. Now, last week, she asked all of us to engage in an exercise to think about power. Where is it located for us? Where does it appear in the relationships with other people? And what might happen if we said no? And I tell you what, I tried it out. I hope all of you did. And it was a lot more difficult than I thought, just trying to observe how it feels inside me and how it appears in the relationship with other people. So I'm going to give it another go this week. But first, let's hear what she's going to tell us this week about power and how we can overcome some of those barriers that hold us back. Well, let's start with assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum salam.
In terms of women's power, whether that's female power or feminine power, it can become a very toxic conversation. What is that toxicity?
I believe the toxicity comes from both sides. It comes from the side where we are requested to respond, and it comes from our lack of understanding of how do we actually portray our innate power. And it's always, for me, the question is that we forget to ask this question from ourselves: is this okay with me? It's a very simple question, but we never ask it ourselves. And whatever situation we go into, we just react as opposed to asking and responding. I call it the anchoring question, because when I have this anchor, it's almost like a pillar inside of us. And if I have it at the back of my mind, constantly playing, then whatever comes to me, I look at that thing, whatever comes, and then I ask, is this okay with me? And if this is not okay with me, how else would I like it to be? What else would I do? How would I need to approach this? What would I need to respond? How would I need to navigate this? And I think that's where we really, you bring power alive by doing it, not thinking about it, but in action, you can constantly steer and navigate yourself by coming back to, is this okay with me? And if it's not, what do I need to say? How do I need to say it? What is the hard conversation I need to have? So you navigate from internal from your internal compass, and this is how you unfold your power, because then your dignity constantly is going to be building up.
You're saying the opposite of what we normally think about as power, which is that we should have power first and then we can say no, whereas you're saying that when we say no, that's actually what builds up the power for us.
I believe so. Yeah, you see that's the reason why I really believe that when we have a connection to the understanding of power, is power doesn't come with labels, it doesn't come with titles, it doesn't come with positions. I have coached very powerful people who have got the position to be powerful, but they are meek. They don't know how to have a hard conversation. They don't know how to talk to their spouse at home. They don't know how to navigate. They power through, and they power over, as opposed to power with. And my definition of power is always about, I much rather power with people than power over people, because power over is dominance.
When we are trying to assert our power, we're trying to verb the power as opposed to noun it. So it's not that we have power, it's that we do power. There are things that can make it really difficult. And, you know, I have a sense of rising anxiety when I think about some of these. So when you try to assert yourself, the other person gets angry, or there's rage, even violence, which is, of course, terrifying. There is a fear. And I think all of us have felt that. I can feel my anxiety rising just thinking about when people push back. How do those mechanisms stop us from asserting our power?
In a major way, because what we do in those kind of scenarios, we are taking other people's anger and we feel responsible for it. Oh, he's angry because of me. Whereas he's angry because he's angry. And there's nothing I can do about his anger. I can do something about my response, but there's nothing I can do. So if I have an argument with my husband and he gets angry, very early in our marriage, we made this deal that when you are angry or I'm angry, we don't blame the other. Nobody makes us angry.
That's a really common phrase, isn't it? Don't do that. You're making me angry.
Yeah, nobody makes you angry. You chose to be angry in a situation. I said what I needed to say. If that makes you angry, that's your responsibility. And I believe women often take the bait and think, oh, I'm responsible for someone being angry. Oh, I don't want to make someone, I want to keep the peace. It's my fault. I did something. What did I say? What did I do? And I think it comes down to really, again, back to dignity, back to self-worth, is that we say what we need to say. The reaction from the other person is not our responsibility. How we handle that reaction is our responsibility, but not how they feel. And we can't take the bait over and over again, because then what is our life going to be?
I'm having one of those moments, you know, where the clouds part and you see the sun and there's like an angel thing. Because if I say it's my fault, and it isn't, I have relinquished my power in that situation, haven't I?
Absolutely.
And I've relinquished my dignity.
Absolutely.
Which means I've relinquished my humanity.
Perfectly said.
I'm going to cry. What is it inside us then that makes it hard for women to take that power?
I think generally, lack of self-worth, lack of self-esteem, not having any sense of self. And I know a lot of women, and I was one of them, not even a long many years ago, that I didn't actually know what my self-worth meant, what it looks like, what it feels like. But once you find it and you start building and practicing and centering yourself around that self, sense of self, then everything becomes a lot more manageable, a lot easier, and less toxic on our soul. But also it's empowering in a way that you empower yourself. That's why I don't like the word empowerment, because women don't need empowerment. Women need space to think. Women need time to reflect. Women need time to sit and just have a real proper time without disturbance, without children, without anyone asking for socks, without anyone asking for what I need to do. Women need undivided time to think and reflect about themselves. And there's no better time than Ramadan.
Ramadan is a great time for that. Thinking specifically about some of those social mechanisms, I want to hone in on some that seem to affect women in particular. One of them is people pleasing. The say yes to everything, keep the peace, play good wife, good daughter-in-law, good daughter. That sense that we just have to make other people happy. And alongside that, there is guilt. If I don't do that, it's going to be terrible. I'm going to look bad. It's going to be bad. Talk to us about this people-pleasing and this guilt, which I feel like so many of us wear as a cloak and carry in a heavy backpack wherever we go. Mm.
So the interesting thing about this is that all of us want to be part of a good family. We all want to be good neighbors. We all want to be good daughter-in-laws and sister-in-laws, and we all want to do that. But unfortunately, life isn't always like this. It doesn't always play out like that. So we need to always look at the root of our guilt. Is it because I picked up a belief, or I was told and taught by my family that this is a belief that you have to live on, that we always keep the peace and we never have conflict and we don't talk about hard things? If that's the belief, I think that that belief needs to be revisited. And beliefs are, they need to be, values and beliefs, they need to be revisited over time. What once I believed in and valued 15 years ago is no longer relevant, or it changed or it shifted because I have changed and my life has changed. We need to ask ourselves, do I still hold this, whatever the issue is, do I still hold this as solemn and sacred? Or does it need reframing, rephrasing? Do I need to have a conversation with someone that, because this relationship doesn't quite work for me anymore? And if I want to keep the relationship, what do I need to do to make it work? How can I develop a better relationship based on that both of us are, I am okay and you are okay too? What women tend to do is like, as long as everyone is okay, I don't matter. And I think that's really, it's the breeding ground for resentment, you know, guilt, shame even. And that's, it just really opens the door for depression. And then even further, it opens the door for abuse.
And I was going to say, all of those words you were talking about, they're all energy vampires. They suck the energy out of you and they disable you from being able to be your full self. But if you are able to set those boundaries, what does a healthy boundary look like? What does it feel like? How do we identify it?
I love this because I learned this with my children, actually. I really did when then they were born. So one of the first sign is that you can verbalize your feelings. And this is very simple. It sounds really simple. But I have worked with so many people who, when you ask them, how are you feeling, they have a very limited vocabulary. I'm fine. I'm okay. I'm this, I'm that. It's very limited. I mean, we have got, I don't know, 14,000 words for expressing emotions. Why don't we use the shades of those words? Why don't we become specific about how you actually feel? You can be happy and you can be also anxious at the same time. So holding and being able to verbalize feelings is really, really important. Second is that you actually value your emotions and your rights to have those emotions. I have the right to be angry. Now, what I do with it is my responsibility, but I have a right to be angry about something. Number three, you can listen and trust your intuition. And when you do, your intuition is going to tell you a lot of things. And when you are acting from intuition, boundary crossing is much harder for people. Because remember, boundaries are not crossed by people because they are bad people. It's because we are not holding up the boundaries for them. What we do is we think about boundaries, but we don't actually put into practice. Number four is you are actually saying what you are thinking. Because I know a lot of us, we have one world in our head and we have another world of what we say. We want to be politically correct. We want to be polite to certain people in the family because that's what's requested of us. But we are thinking something else. And even worse, we go back and we start gossiping about them to somebody else. I don't think that's in alignment. And it's certainly it's not authentic. And I don't believe it's actually Islamic in any shape or form. Number five is the question that we always need to ask ourselves. Is this okay with me? Number six, I often talk about this as a state of centeredness. When we are aligned with ourselves and we are aligned with our Allah, we know that we have a standing, we have a position, we have a purpose, and we have things to do. And for that, we are willing to stand in conflict. Number seven is comfortably, you are comfortable saying no, and you don't have the residue of guilt or, you know, whatever else people feel when they say no. You say no and you are really okay with the no. And it's a very hard practice to have. And number eight is you recognize power struggles, but you don't get consumed by them. Power struggle is always going to be power over as opposed to I want to do power with.
You said the magic word no. And in episode one, we talked about the yes and the no and the challenges of asserting no in particular. And a lot of us, I think, will understand the abstract concept of saying no, which is easier said than done. Particularly when we want to keep the peace or in Ramadan, you know, tempers can be running high and we're also a bit hangry. But it is important to assert that no. Talk us through the kinds of reactions we might get to start with when we say no from other people, but also inside ourselves. So we can kind of map our journey and know how we're getting closer and closer to asserting our no.
Right. It's a little bit like being in conflict. Nobody likes doing that, but we have to learn how to be in conflict, right? So when you do it for the first time, you end up in a conflict situation. It really feels very weird. I don't really know what to say. My throat is dry. I'm kind of sweating and I've got anxiety in my stomach.
You want to run away. You're like, I didn't mean it, right?
Yeah, I don't even want to talk about this. So saying no for the first time is exactly the same. You know, we have almost like a somatic reaction for doing things that we are not used to. But just like with anything else in life, when you train yourself and you train the body to be okay with the no, it's actually, it really is magic once you have it. But it's the practice of doing it, and you cannot read about it. You cannot think about it. You have to do it. You have to do it in practice. Just like conflict, you can't go to a conflict management seminar and suddenly all your conflicts are going to disappear. You have to go home and you have to have that hard conversation and be in conflict to be able to go through some of the bodily driven reactions, because we all have them. So this is just human psychology. And as you start saying no, so the reactions you will most likely get, I believe, you are selfish because, oh, you have never been like this. Why are you saying no? You always said yes. What happened to you now? Why is it a no now? Or you are so self-absorbed. You only think about yourself, a different expression of selfishness. But also, you know, anger coming from people who expect certain things from us, and we are no longer able to fulfill those requests. But the request and the fulfillment of request, we personally have a choice over. So if I can no longer fulfill that request, it's absolutely my imperative to say no, because if I keep saying yes, I am going to be the one who's going to keep suffering.
In terms of a takeaway, talking about the social mechanisms that other people impose on us and the way that we shy away sometimes from asserting our power and our dignity, what practical tasks can you give us so that we can practice how to assert that no boundary, how we can push back on those mechanisms?
So because we talked about no and we talked about boundaries, I really would love our listeners to actually go around in their lives and look at their conflicting situations. Where are you in conflict in your life? And look at everything. You get every single area of your life and highlight the conflicts. And I'm going to give you three things that will help you hopefully to look at those conflicts. Analyze those conflicts based on what are the sources of those conflicts. Are you in conflict because of a task? Is it task related? Are you in conflict because it's a relationship issue between you two or whoever it is involved? Or are you in conflict because it's based on a value difference? So task-related conflict, relationship-related conflict, or value-related. And just have a little bit of a map out of where your conflicts are. And I give you also a little bit of an extra exercise.
Bonus homework.
Bonus homework is I want you to pick up one of those conflicting situations and do the no. And do it a couple of times. So about a week, probably you can do it twice. So say no twice to the same person or the same situation and see what happens.
I won't say yes, Henrietta Savatti. Thank you so much for shedding light on the ways that women's power is pushed back and how we can take our no to ensure that we have our dignity and humanity. Thank you.
Thank you.
All throughout this series, it's about your voices. What does it mean to be a Muslim woman? So I want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what we've been talking about? Get in touch and share your ideas so we can hear them and think about them together.
Shame, fear of stepping outside of cultural norms, fear of not living up to expectations of yourself. Fear, I'd say. Fear is probably stopping myself and other people from achieving their power.
Self-doubt, anxiety, social barriers, lack of opportunities. Unfortunately, we still see in many of our mosques women denied a voice or positions of influence, which is a detriment to the whole community, sadly. And it really does hinder our development as an ummah.
I feel in every aspect, what has stopped me from achieving my power is judgment from the society.
I feel at times I am probably my biggest hindrance, whether it be because of external factors that make me doubt myself at times, but also sometimes I feel like we don't have enough examples of people to follow or ask for guidance in order to follow their path and succeed in their ways.
This is Muslim Women Talk Ramadan. It's about Muslim women talking. So get those voice notes into me so we can share your thoughts and talk to each other. If you want to find me on my socials, look up Shalina Jan Mohammed or Love in a Headscarf and just click send. Right, let's get to our special guest for this week. And I am so excited to welcome her to the podcast in just a moment. She was the Minister of Foreign Affairs in the Maldives from 2013 to 2016 and the first woman to hold that post. And she has such an impressive CV. She studied social anthropology at Cambridge and holds two master's degrees, including research centred on gender activism and Islamic revival. During her ministerial role, she was key in strengthening the Maldives' international relations, especially with India, Sri Lanka and Pakistan. She developed the country's climate diplomacy and under her leadership negotiated the 2030 agenda and the Paris Agreement in 2015. And not just all of that, she was leading the team that drafted the Maldives' anti-domestic violence legislation. She really is a woman who makes a difference and gets stuff done. Welcome to Muslim Women Talk Ramadan, Dunya Momoon. Dunya, hello and salam alaikum.
Salam alaikum, Shalina. It's a pleasure to join you in this conversation.
You are all the way over in the Maldives. How is Ramadan going for you?
It's going well, and Ramadan Mubarak. Hope you and your family are well, and wishing you a very peaceful and blessed Ramadan.
Now, invite us into your Ramadan. Start by painting us a picture of what Ramadan is like for you in the Maldives.
I think it is definitely a very special occasion. Maldivians, as you know, are Muslims, and we take pride in calling ourselves a 100% Muslim country. In a Muslim country, I think Ramadan is very different to what it is in some countries where Muslims are in the minority, because the whole country is kind of adapting and changing working hours, school hours, and many things in order to welcome Ramadan. For my family and I, it's definitely always a very special time. We make sure we spend more time together and definitely eating iftar together, joining in prayers together, I think makes Ramadan very, very special for us.
Now, all of the guests that we have on the podcast, I ask them the same quick questions right at the beginning so we get a feeling of what it's like. So here we go. Nice quick questions. What do you love about Ramadan?
I think I love that it gives me a chance to focus on strengthening my faith, on introspection, on reflection, on looking at all the things that I need to do to improve as a person. And at the same time, gives me the opportunity to spend time with my parents, my children, my husband, to make sure that they have a good Ramadan as well, and to make sure that we all speak and work together to improve ourselves. It's a good time.
And what do you find challenging?
I think the challenge is always, while one has the intention, or I have the intention to improve as a Muslim, to improve myself as a person, and to look at planning how we go about it, it's always the implementation that is the challenge.
And why is Ramadan important to you?
I think Ramadan gives us the much needed time to slow down. And for me, this Ramadan in particular has been a slower one. I was very involved in my career, in work, in politics, in previous Ramadans. And I think in a way, Allah has given me this blessing where I can slow down, and I have the blessings of time and with the support of people around me to actually center myself, if you would say, to focus more on the spiritual side and to focus more on the real things that matter, that I think when we are busy with many things, we often tend to forget. And in a way, I am very grateful to Allah for being given this opportunity, that I am blessed to be able to take that time out.
Listeners will also know that I'm a big fan of the samosa for Ramadan. If we came to the Maldives, what would be the traditional thing that we would always look forward to in Ramadan?
Definitely you would have samosa, and I think there were a lot of snacks that are made for the feast that is there at the end of the fast. We have a lot of Maldivian adika, names such as gula, pokiba, and a lot of savory and sweet items, and a lot of fruit juices that are drunk throughout the night. Of course, hydration is important. So yes, a lot of focus on food, as in many countries and cultures, but I tend to always tell my family, look, it's not just the food, it's a much more important process that we're going through in terms of learning patience, in learning to control many of the bodily needs, if you will, and giving us the time to focus on mental strength and many other things that Islam enjoins upon us or tries to encourage within us. So all in all, it's a good time to visit, but I guess many Muslims would prefer to be in their homes rather than travel during Ramadan.
Now, Dunya, you don't have one, not two, you have 3 degrees, including 2 masters. And I'm really fascinated by the journey you started on in studying particularly around women and Muslim women and Islamic revival. Can you talk to us about that first step you took on that journey of studying, and what was it you wanted to study, and why did you pick that?
Yes, I left my home and I went to UK to do A-levels, and I was very lucky to be able to do my first degree in social anthropology at Cambridge, as you mentioned. I chose a subject which I thought I would enjoy and find challenging. I think the issue of women and women's rights and how what Islam enjoined upon women, or the rights that Islam gave to women. And I think because the Western feminism and the narrative was so much about Muslim women being oppressed. And at the same time, I was brought up within the Muslim heritage and with parents who were very aware, very educated, but very strong Muslims. And the upbringing they gave us, I never felt that women were deprived of anything or that women did not have the ability or the chance to go into education or work or careers that they enjoyed. So I think that was, it was like a personal journey where I was looking for answers as to, can it be that this faith, which is shared by millions across the world, and how the love we hold for our Prophet, and also looking at the scriptures, can it really be the case that women were degraded, or women were to be treated differently in such a major faith? So it was a personal thing very much, because I wanted to see and understand and learn how other Muslim women had tackled this issue, and also to understand what the scriptures said. And it was very enlightening for me.
And if you were to sum up in maybe a sentence, what did you discover?
I think I discovered that the Prophet Muhammad himself encouraged women to be active in communities, in fact, even in leadership positions. We heard of the Prophet's wife, Aisha radiallahu anha, who herself led an army into battle. So many things that generally Muslims may not know, I think became evident when I was doing my research. And from there, it gave me also the encouragement that I could go out into the world to be in politics, to be in any leadership positions, or to be in careers and work without that guilt that many women do experience at times, because often there is criticism from the community or society as to how good a mother is she, how are the children being brought up, all those issues. I think we as women do think about a lot more than men, because these are important issues to us.
Yeah, we can definitely exchange notes about bringing up the children and working full-time jobs. But you were talking about how the work you did really, I guess, maybe gave you an inner platform to push yourself out into the public space, which is a perfect segue into talking about your role as a foreign minister. I have to say, Dunya, it's not often I get to talk to a foreign minister every day, so this is pretty exciting for me. And I was looking at the UN data on how many women are ministers on a global platform. And even today, only about a quarter, it's 23%. And those typically tend to be in things like equalities roles or social and family roles, not a foreign minister role like you held between 2013 and 2016. So I imagine even in that time, it was less common for there to be women. So how did it feel when you stepped up into that global stage?
It was definitely an honour, and I really enjoyed the challenge, and it was a great learning experience. Let me share with you, once I went to a meeting in Saudi Arabia, and it was of the Organisation of the Islamic Conference, foreign ministers across the world. I think the first time I went, I was the only woman foreign minister there, which was definitely a very unique experience. But what was heartening was second time around, a couple of years after that, when I went to the same meeting, there were 5 women foreign ministers from Muslim countries across the world. So that was very good to see. But definitely to go into a non-stereotypical and a pretty powerful position, as you would see in the cabinet as a foreign minister, was a challenge. And at the same time, it was a very rewarding experience. Today, we see so many more women ambassadors, and I'm so happy to see that. And I have also seen very supportive husbands who have been by the side of their wives as they face their challenges in countries across the world.
Do you know what? You are so eloquent and so articulate and so thoughtful. But I'm sitting here wondering, when you stepped into that role, were you scared? Like, were you terrified? What was like the inner voice inside you?
Actually, I think because of the politics of what happened in the country, initially I went from the United Nations Population Fund to join the Foreign Ministry as Deputy Minister. And then our country, as it went into its journey as a young democracy, we saw a lot of instability where governments changed very quickly. And at one point in time, Maldives was accused of a certain political parties of supporting a coup in the country. So I actually had the opportunity to come as foreign minister much earlier, but I turned it down because I felt that the timing was inappropriate. And me coming from a particular political family background, it may not have been the right time. So after the 2013 election, when the president offered me that position at that time, I felt I was going into the position with the experience and really deserving of that position. And I was looking forward to that challenge. So it was definitely an honor. And I think during my time, I was able to uphold the respect for our country. Although we are a small, tiny country by comparison to many others, we are a proud people with our own language, our culture, our history, and we hold on very strongly to our Islamic faith. So it was a challenge, and I think I did work to the best of my ability. We went through very rough times, but I faced the rest of the world. I was able to defend the Maldivian people during that time.
You know, we've all seen that huge UN council hall with the circular benches. When you went on there the first time, what was going through your mind? Because it's like a lot of people and they're really important. And certainly for us lay people, we're like, this is where it happens. What does it feel like for you?
I think I had familiarity with the United Nations because my first serious job was working at the United Nations Population Fund. So I had had some work experience where I worked on reproductive health, on gender issues, on issues to do with youth, to do with drug use, domestic violence. And then when the tsunami struck Maldives in December 2004, I was one of the senior people at the UN, and we faced a huge disaster crisis situation. And so again, I had a lot of experience working with the resident coordinator, as they would call the head of the UN office here, and many other organizations that came in. And we were able to lobby and work with that government to bring in funding to support the projects that were underway to recover from the tsunami as such. It was definitely a very different thing to go as foreign minister. I was able to hold a number of bilateral meetings, but my most memorable, or something that is a really special memory to me, is speaking at the United Nations General Assembly and speaking on issues that were close to heart for Maldivians, and also including on the Palestine issue, on climate change, on a number of issues. So, no, it wasn't terrifying, probably because I was very ready for those kind of situations. And also, I give full credit to my team. They were an excellent team. And in fact, when I went to give my most famous speech, if you will, at the podium at the United Nations, I had a lot of training by the girls at the foreign ministry who got me to practice well in front of the podium. So I was able to go ahead very smoothly, very with a good delivery on that speech. And it's definitely a proud moment for me.
So a few moments ago, you talked about a big moment at the United Nations. And I think you were referring to 2014 when you spoke at the UN Security Council after there'd been a significant assault on Palestine. And there'd also been a crippling blockage in which at least 800 Palestinians were killed. And you co-sponsored a resolution to set up an international commission of inquiry to investigate the atrocities. That's quite a significant thing to do. And did you feel you needed to be brave to do something like that?
I am proud as a Maldivian to have been part of that process, to have been part of bringing in the resolutions, and even now to be a Maldivian to support justice, I would say, justice for the Palestinian people and their right to have safe homes and to be able to go on with their lives. And if we see the current ceasefire going through, it would definitely be something that would make me and many Maldivians happy, although we are seeing in the news, you know, things have not been that rosy. But we live in hope, and I hope to see a day where Palestinians are given their rights in full. And one significant other memory, if I can share with you, I was at the UN when the Palestinian flag was first raised. And if I remember right, that was in 2015. So again, another proud moment, and so much for an issue that is close to our hearts here in the Maldives.
Do you think of yourself as a powerful person?
I do. I know that the focus of your programs have been on power, and I had spent some time having some thoughts about it and about what power means and how the ability to make your own decisions, ability to influence others, which could be power over others, but also including power over oneself. And I know that I have been in leadership positions, and I feel or think of myself very much as a leader. And I know even wherever I work, I'm able to gain the respect and love of others. And I think that's the real power, or that's the power that is important to me to work towards. At the same time, you see how power can be abused, how power can be used for not good things, how once you are in powerful positions, you're not serving the country or other people, but instead you're moving on to serve your own self. And I think definitely from the family I come from and the generation of politicians that I come from, we are very sad to see this in our own country at present.
How do you keep yourself on the right side of power?
It's not an easy thing, but I think, again, I can attribute a lot to my Muslim faith and the values that were ingrained in me, and what I see from my mentors, who are my parents, really, and especially my father. So I think it's something that probably is ingrained in you, but I see many people who suddenly come into power. It's like sometimes people who suddenly come into money. I think how they are and how they treat other people is often affected by the fact that maybe they didn't have the right values when they were growing. I'm not at all trying to kind of blow my own trumpet. Of course, I have a lot of work to do to improve myself as a Muslim and to improve myself as a person, and to improve how I interact with others or how I serve my community and family. But I'm just saying, as a general thing, what is inside you will come out. So ultimately, you cannot fool people. You cannot pretend to be a generous, a kind, an honest person, because who you are does come out.
Now, Zunya, you're so accomplished that I haven't even got to so many of your achievements, like the work you did on pioneering legislation in the Maldives against domestic violence, about the relationships that you brokered for the Maldives across the region you live in. But one of the things I really loved of what you said is that you owned your power. You said, yes, I'm a powerful woman. And I really love that. And I feel like I need to go home and practice saying that myself, although I'm not sure I can look in the mirror and do that. But behind that public power, behind all the achievements you have, are there like two or three words that you think about yourself, or nerves you have, or you wish I wish I could do more of that? What are you thinking about yourself inside?
I think, Shalina, you are a very accomplished woman. I just wanted to note that as an author, as a presenter, and as someone who's initiating these very important conversations with a lot of other much more accomplished women as well, just want to say that it's an honor for me to talk to you. And it's a bit embarrassing when you talk to me about my accomplishments. I have come somewhere, and I hope that I can in future also serve my community using my abilities. I think one thing that I found through the journey has been that from childhood through academia into jobs, my life has been very blessed. That's one thing. And it came with a lot of support from my family, from being born into a particular family, from having the ability to study well, to go to best universities, all that. What was more challenging was for me when I faced failure. So last year for me, standing as a member of parliament with my experience, with my education, and then not winning was a big shock in many ways. And I think it took me some time to deal with. But where I am now, I feel that perhaps Allah gave me something that I needed without giving me what I wanted. Maybe I needed that kind of time to stop and reflect and think and really understand the blessings around me and not be always kind of addicted to politics, if you wish, in a way, and gave me the time with my family. I have a wonderful husband. I have great kids. I have wonderful parents who are in their elderly years and definitely need my time and care as well.
Well, we wish you every success in this pause, the rest that it sounds like you very much deserve. And we can't wait to hear what's going to be your next chapter. Thank you so much for joining us on Muslim Women Talk Ramadan Dunya Mormon.
Thank you so much, Shalina. And it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, and wishing you the best Ramadan and wishing you all the best for the future. And I'm sure we will have many more conversations, inshallah. All the best. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of Muslim Women Talk Ramadan with me, Shalina Jan Mohammed. I hope you've been as uplifted and inspired as I have by Hannah and Iman, Henrietta and Dunya. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please do recommend us to your friends, have conversations about power with them, and then come back and listen to our next episode where we've got another incredible guest. I can't quite believe I'm going to get to sit down and chat to her, so join us for that. I really hope this podcast has given you some time and space to think and reflect during these busy few weeks, and I look forward to talking with you next time.